their community.
Compared to other U.S. populations, Indigenous peoples see higher mortality rates and more chronic conditions, partly due to being far away from quality care. Coleman says she hopes this partnership could help bridge that gap. I'm Hannah Mersbach.
A Native American man who was one of three iron workers who died in a construction accident 25 years ago this summer was recently remembered at a public ceremony. Chuck Kornbach reports.
William DeGrave, Jeffrey Wisher, and Jerome Starr died in July 1999 when the so-called man basket they were in crashed to the ground. That was after a crane was unable to control a 450-ton piece of metal roofing being lifted in a strong wind. The construction project was a new Major League Baseball stadium, now called American Family Field, where the Milwaukee Brewers play. Jerome Starr was Ojibwe. Part of a recent ironworkers-sponsored remembrance ceremony outside the ballpark included tribal member Maynard Webster performing an honor song. Later, Starr's sister, Catherine Hamilton Starr, choked up while talking to a reporter about her relative.
He was a great brother. He was always providing for everybody, always cared about everybody. He was very caring. He was always there in need of anything, very close.
Standing next to Catherine was her daughter, Jerome Starr's niece, Dawn Hamilton, who tearfully relayed a favorite memory.
Going over to Uncle Jerry's house in the summertime to go swimming.
Yeah.
And then the holidays or whatever, he always opened up his home. Everybody in the family, everybody and anybody was welcome. He kept us united.
Hamilton and others also took part in a smudging ceremony to pray for the deceased. Hamilton says she's grateful all of those who passed away building a ballpark were honored. I'm Chuck Kornbach.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 1st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedov and Suzanne Potter, the producers Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service, Native Voice One, and Dr. Chris Nichols with OSU. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Venezuelan election results disputed. Low U.S. expectations of post-election Iran. And Taiwan president's rhetoric invites Chinese pressure. First, Venezuela's election results disputed. Two things were predictable about the Venezuelan presidential election. First, that President Nicolas Maduro would claim victory no matter what. He said he will win by hook or by crook. And second, that the opposition would declare victory based on polling. When the polls closed, the Election Commission, whose independence is suspect, declared Maduro the victor by 51% to 44%, whereas all the exit polls by both U.S. and Venezuelan organizations showed that Edmundo Gonzalez would win 65% of the vote to Maduro's 31% or less. There are reports that the opposition was unable to monitor the vote at polling stations, and the Maduro government prevented a plane carrying the ex-presidents of Mexico, Panama, Costa Rica, and Bolivia, all critics of the current Venezuelan government, from landing. They said they wanted to observe the election and were hoping for an opposition victory. Leaders from around the hemisphere generally reacted in disbelief. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. had, quote, serious concerns that the result announced does not represent the will or the votes of the Venezuelan people. Chile's President Gabriel Boric said, quote, Maduro's regime must understand that the results are hard to believe. The international community, and especially the Venezuelan people, including the millions of Venezuelans in exile, demand total transparency. From Chile, we will not recognize any result that is not verifiable. Bernardo Arevalo, president of Guatemala, agreed, quote, Venezuela deserves transparent, accurate results that adhere to the will of its people. We received the results announced by the Election Commission with many doubts. This is why electoral observation mission reports are essential, and today, more than ever, must defend Venezuelans' votes. Peru recalled its ambassador, its foreign minister saying, quote, I condemn in all extremity the sum of irregularities with the intention of fraud committed by the Venezuelan government. Peru will not accept the violation of the popular will of the Venezuelan people, unquote. The reactions of Brazil's and Colombia's leaders also were skeptical. Only the presidents of Cuba, Honduras, and Bolivia congratulated Maduro. What happens next is hard to predict. Maduro might enter into talks with the opposition or take the low road and try to suppress it. U.S. sanctions on the Maduro government, mainly on its oil exports, are likely to continue, at least as long as Biden is president. A Trump presidency will mean much harsher conditions and even more direct intervention to topple Maduro. A key factor is the reaction of the Venezuelan people. Will popular demonstrations go on, and will they be large enough and widespread enough to change the minds of the military leadership and overthrow Maduro? Low U.S. expectations for post-election Iran. The election of a new reform-minded president in Iran has not led to optimism in Washington about improving relations. Quote, we have no expectations that this election will lead to a fundamental change in Iran's direction or its policies, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. At the end of the day, it's not the president that has the ultimate say over the future of Iran's policy. It is the supreme leader, and of course we have seen the direction that he has chosen to take Iran. Obviously, if the new president had the authority to make steps to curtail Iran's nuclear program, to stop funding terrorism, to stop destabilizing activities in the region, those would be steps that we would welcome. But needless to say, we don't have any expectations that that's what's likely to ensue, unquote. On top of that, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the breakout time for Iran to produce a nuclear weapon is down to 1 to 2 weeks. He doesn't think it's possible to return to nuclear talks. That horse has left the barn, he's convinced. Yet another well-informed report from the Carnegie Endowment suggests that one reform President Pezeshkian will pursue is disengagement from Russia. Anti-Russian feeling in Iranian society is not likely to disappear anytime soon, writes Nikita Spagin, and Pezeshkian's victory should serve as a warning sign for the Kremlin. Cooperation with Tehran could become much harder in the future. He goes on to write, when it comes to foreign policy, this desire for change manifests itself as wanting to see an end to Iran's global isolation. In other words, the normalization of ties with the West. Pezeshkian spoke a lot about this during the election campaign and, like past reformers, openly called for better relations with Europe and dialing down tensions with the United States. What the Carnegie analysis and the U.S. State Department comments have in common is pessimism about prospects for policy shifts in Tehran. The State Department demands changes that Iran's supreme leader surely won't make. And the Carnegie report argues that the one U.S. policy change that must precede closer relations with the West, reducing sanctions on Iran, is very unlikely to happen given Israel-Iran tensions, Iran's nuclear program, and the upcoming U.S. election. Making the prospect of change even more remote is that Pezeshkian spoke with Vladimir Putin soon after the election and proposed that Iran and Russia sign a long-delayed strategic cooperation agreement. Taiwan president's rhetoric invites Chinese pressure. Starting with his inauguration speech,
Taiwan President Lai Ching-te has emphasized Taiwan's sovereignty, a position guaranteed to anger Beijing, which claims the island nation as its own. Although Taiwan's previous leader, Tsai Ing-wen, also insisted that Taiwan be treated as a separate entity, she did not officially embrace the idea of Taiwan's sovereignty. She understood, as does the current president, that Beijing's red line for direct intervention is a Taiwan declaration of independence. President Lai has not spoken of declaring independence, but he has said that as a practical matter, quote, according to international law, we are already a sovereign and independent country. Such statements are enough to make him a target of official Chinese attacks, and more importantly, an escalation of harassing air and naval maneuvers near the island, to which Lai has responded with increased military preparedness. It's a dangerous situation at a time when President Biden and President Xi Jinping have tried to dampen tensions over Taiwan. Carefully managing the Taiwan issue may prove very difficult in a Trump administration. As Trump has demonstrated in the past, financial gain and vindictiveness are hallmarks of his approach to international relations, whether friends or adversaries. Recall that Trump entered office in 2017, believing that both Japan and China had ripped off the U.S. in trade relations, setting the stage for high tariffs on their exports. So, when he was asked in an interview with Bloomberg News on June 25 what his policy would be on Taiwan, his thoughts were not about defending the island, which Republicans in Congress consider the first priority, but this, quote, "They, Taiwan, did take about 100% of our chip business. Taiwan should pay us for defense. You know, we're no different than an insurance company. Taiwan doesn't give us anything. Taiwan is 9,500 miles away. It's 68 miles away from China," unquote. Taiwan's advanced semiconductor industry is the great prize for China, Trump said. The apple of Xi's eye, Trump kept saying. Therefore, something they want to acquire without bombing. But Taiwan is too far away to defend, Trump seemed to say. He then repeated his upset. Now we're giving them billions of dollars to build new chips in our country, and then they're going to take that too. In other words, they'll build it, but then they'll bring it back to their country. These remarks don't go so far as to indicate that Trump would abandon Taiwan. He would face heavy Republican pressure to adhere at least to the traditional U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity, neither pledging to defend Taiwan nor pledging not to. Indeed, that was his administration's position in the first Trump administration. Still, his comments should prompt the new Taiwan administration to tread more cautiously when making statements about sovereignty that provoke a strong Chinese reaction. In other news, executive immunity and the CIA. Former intelligence officers, writing in the Washington Post, point out how the recent Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity could empower a president to use the CIA for missions once proscribed. As they write, quote, "In practical terms, this means that a president may direct the CIA or a private paramilitary organization to engage in illegal activities. A president could also order the director of the CIA not to brief Congress on such activities," unquote. CIA actions that once required approval from congressional committees or the attorney general, such as the assassination of a foreign leader or surveillance of American citizens and foreign governments, could now require nothing more than a nod from the president. Even elimination of a political rival could be regarded as falling within the chief executive's official duties, just as Justice Sotomayor suggested in her dissent from the Supreme Court's decision. The two former CIA officials conclude, quote, "The Trump decision thus manages to turn the essence of the Nuremberg trials, that just following orders is not a defense to a war crime, on its head. It provides absolute immunity for the president, unqualified authority to pardon in advance underlings who follow illegal orders, and no legal accountability for obvious criminal activity." China's relations with Japan and India are not going well, but on the mend with Italy. At a critical point, that's the phrase used by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi to describe relations with Japan in a meeting with his Japanese counterpart late last month. Differences in China-Japan relations have mounted recently. For Japan, they involve China's hold on fish imports from Japan due to concern about food safety since the Fukushima nuclear meltdown, and China's arrest of a Japanese business executive. China's issues with Japan include limits on semiconductor exports to China and long-running territorial disputes. Both countries have resumed high-level contacts, so the notion of a critical point may be exaggerated. But on the other hand, Japan's closer alignment with U.S., South Korean, and Philippines military plans spell containment to Chinese officials. Minister Wang also met with India's foreign minister. It is clear from the Chinese readout of the meeting that current relations are not satisfactory. Quote, China and India, as two major neighboring developing countries and emerging economies, should step up dialogue and communication, increase understanding and mutual trust, properly handle differences, and develop mutually beneficial cooperation, unquote. As has been true for many years, conflict over their border is a primary reason for mistrust. India's foreign minister said, quote, India and China have widely intertwined interests and are also facing the shadow brought by the border situation, but the Indian side is willing to find a solution to differences and bring bilateral relations back to the positive and constructive track. The two sides agreed to work together to maintain peace in the border areas and push for new progress in the consultation on border affairs, unquote. The two countries do have several avenues for working out differences on the border, but so far these pledges of mutual understanding have not produced agreement on where the border lies. On a better note for China, Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni visited Beijing at the end of July in an effort to repair the damage caused by Italy's decision in 2019 to withdraw from China's Belt and Road Initiative. The two countries agreed on an industrial collaboration memorandum that covers electric vehicles and renewable energy. Fiat will join with a Chinese company in producing an EV to market in Europe, and China pledges to open its markets to more Italian products. Finally, indigenous leaders in Latin America fight corporate colonialism. Multinational corporations have long been using a provision of U.S. trade agreements to sue host governments if they're not allowed to invest in projects on the lands of indigenous people. The trade provision, known as the Investor-State Dispute Settlement, gives corporations the right to sue if their quote-unquote investor rights are blocked by local laws, including those that protect indigenous people's property and environment. For example, the Honduran government is being sued for nearly $11 billion by a U.S. company that is being prevented by law from setting up a trade zone under its own rule. An indigenous community was successful at gaining repeal of the law that had originally allowed that zone. And in Ecuador, two indigenous communities had successfully challenged Chevron's oil pollution in the Amazon region. When Chevron used the investor-state dispute settlement system to countersue Ecuador, the country terminated all trade agreements with the U.S. that contained that provision. The action was then approved in a nationwide referendum. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. According to a recent article on the website of the British medical journal The Lancet, it would not be implausible to estimate that up to 186,000 and possibly more people have been killed in Israel's war on Gaza. That's a significantly higher death toll than what Gaza's Ministry of Health has been reporting. Jennifer Lowenstein is a freelance journalist and former associate director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the death count in Gaza and related issues.
I remember hearing that the Hamas figures are kind of conservative because they want to make sure that they're counting accurately. And then there's other figures, Ralph Nader among others, who put the number not at around 40,000, but at around 200,000. And that's referring to people buried under the debris and who are missing in action, who haven't been found. Is that something that you agree with, that there might be many more deaths than
I have long thought that there are and will be much greater numbers than we're seeing now. I think the 186,000 that the Lancet just estimated as a probable death toll is, that could even be low. And I wanted to say one thing. people are constantly, not you, but, you know, you turn on the mainstream media and you hear the Hamas-run Ministry of Health and you hear the Hamas-run this. I think that's so misleading, because Hamas-run in the sense, well, that Hamas won the last election and is, you know, is the government, essentially. But the people working for the Ministry of Health are not necessarily Hamas party members. They certainly don't necessarily have any political leanings one way or another. Just they're people who tabulate and work and do what you have to do in a ministry. And my experience living and working in Gaza, in my case, at a human rights organization back in 2002, is that whenever field workers or office workers have to tabulate numbers or statistics, they tend to be very conservative, because at least where I worked, nothing would be counted as a death, for example, if they were, you know, going out and assessing a recent bombing, unless there was absolute certainty. So they tended to be fairly conservative as well. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that the people working in the Hamas ministry, the Ministry of Health, are probably trained to do the same thing. I mean, as any good professional would be, you have to have evidence in order to back up any claim. So they have to have every number, every person verified. And with as many as 10,000 people possibly under the rubble, you know, those people can't be counted. Not right now. There are bodies all over Gaza City that have been bulldozed into piles or buried in mass graves that are not yet accounted for. There are people dying from malnutrition, dehydration, things that we don't even think about that are byproducts of this war, of this slaughter. So, for example,
people could be shot and not die immediately. And
they could be wounded and die later. But even more, I think, in a more sinister way, my friends, for example, who are my age, 50s, 60s, you know, many of them need medications like we do. High blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, whatever. Those medications are not available right now. There's a high likelihood that some people are going to die as a result of conditions brought on by the current war conditions, and they're not being able to take their regular medications. Certainly somebody with diabetes is going to be facing a real challenge, to say the very least. Then one last thing is that, you know, the World Health Organization and other UN agencies have been telling people that disease is rampant. You know, there's gastrointestinal disease throughout the Gaza Strip. There have been, I believe, evidences of cholera, of hepatitis A. You know, when disease spreads like this, inevitably there are people who die from it or who get very sick. And again, there's no medicine there to treat them. So if we consider all of the possible byproducts of this assault on Gaza, I think the numbers that the Ministry of Health is giving us, by definition, they're very conservative, because they are only counting the known names of people who have been identified.
And meanwhile, the Israelis keep saying they're killing terrorists, so many terrorists, and what do you make of that?
It's really unbelievable to me, because whereas it is possible that Israel will target a person because he is a militant in Hamas, there's no question that what they're doing in the process is targeting that person when he's in a crowded area and killing as many as 200 people as a result. This is what happened.
Well, that's their argument about they're using human shields.
Which is, by the way, absolute garbage. There is no documented evidence by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, by B'Tselem, by any other human rights organization that Hamas has ever used human shields. It doesn't exist. So I like to ask people, you know, if you live in the most densely populated area of land in the world and you happen to be part of a military group, when you go home for supper, are you using your family as human shields? When you walk in the street, are you using the shoppers as human shields? I mean, it's just nuts.
Or they would have to go to an area where there's no people and say, look, Israel, here we are. Come get us.
I mean, exactly. The other thing that really gets on my nerves is the focus on the tunnel network. The Hamas members have dug this, you know, sinister underground subterranean network of tunnels. My immediate thought is, wow, how ingenious. Yeah. You know, you can't move up. You certainly can't leave Gaza. The borders are sealed, including along the sea, because of gunboats. So the only place you can hide is underground. That's the only place you can function.
Didn't the Israelis build some of those tunnels?
The Israelis built some of those tunnels a long time ago, including the ones under Shifa Hospital, which they wanted to make as a Hamas command and control center. That's absolute nonsense. It's not there. It was never there. Tunnels were there because the Israelis built them. And by the way, almost every modern hospital in the world has a tunnels network. The other thing, of course, are the smuggling tunnels. Yes, of course, the smuggling tunnels exist. Gaza has been under a serious siege blockade for, people say, 17 years. It's been a lot longer than 17 years. 17 is the official number. I was there in 2002, before Hamas was ever elected to power. And you still couldn't get in and out of Gaza, not without a lot of haggling and bureaucratic BS. I mean, basically, there are people in a prison. So, yeah, I mean, I take a lot of what the media tells us with a very big grain of salt.
So if it is determined at some point that something like 200,000 people have been, 200,000 Gazans have been killed, do you think it's more likely that the world court will go after Israeli leaders?
I sure hope so. I mean, you've got the International Court.
I mean, 40,000 is quite a big number.
40,000, right. I mean, yeah. I am basically telling people that right now the death toll, the known death toll in Gaza is somewhere between 45,000 and 50,000 people, because the low estimate of people lost under the rubble or missing is around 6,000. That's the low estimate. A higher estimate is between 10 and 12,000. And there are many, many missing, thousands of missing children who are missing for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they were the only member of a family to survive a bombing, and they're lost. They're basically living alone, 10 and 12 year olds. There are siblings taking care of each other because the parents have died. I mean, what has been created in Gaza is literally apocalyptic. It's unbelievable. And I don't know how the people there are managing. I just don't. I don't know how I would survive in those conditions.
This is a little off the subject, although related. Is this some kind of a Christian Zionist dream where this is Armageddon, the beginning of it? Have you heard that? You know,
Lord knows. You know, I was recently writing to a friend of mine, just this morning, and I said, It's harder and harder for me to even imagine talking to someone now who is pro-Israel, because I have friends in Gaza. They were all from Rafah, so they were living in Rafah. All of them have been displaced. Some of them are living in camps and tents right now. I've been in Gaza in the summertime. It is beastly hot. It's not just hot like the desert. It's hot and humid. If you have ever been inside a tent in that weather, you know that it's like a greenhouse. That's how some people are living. There's a shortage of food, a shortage of water. There's basically no really clean water, a shortage of medicine. I have other friends who are living in the houses of friends, which makes, and people have told me this, sometimes 30 people to a flat because of the number of people who have been displaced multiple times. And four of the people I know found out, and I have to tell you this, that their homes have either been bombed and flattened or bulldozed with everything inside. So while they have been displaced to central Gaza currently, They've all learned that they no longer have homes to go back to. And I want to say something about this because I know these people personally. I met them when I worked at a human rights organization. All of them oppose Hamas, all of them, the entire extended family of people. So this idea that Israel is fighting a war against Hamas is, it's nonsense to be very nice about it.
Have you run into pro-Israel people who are nonetheless critical of what Israel's doing now?
You know, that's what I find really puzzling is I haven't. This winter, you know, Tucson, Arizona was one of the cities where the city where many people brought a resolution to the city council to condemn Israel's actions, to condemn it as a genocide, et cetera. And naturally, people on both sides piled into the city council building to speak and give their two cents worth. And you heard, you know, very loud, passionate, you know, pleas on both sides. And I kept waiting. I sat there listening through everything. I sat through hours of these. I never heard a single person who called themselves pro-Israel say something to the effect of, you know, the death toll is really too high. It shouldn't be that way. Civilians shouldn't be targeted. I wish this was not the case. I want that to stop. But I still think Hamas needs to be defeated. Nobody's, you know, it's always black and white. They're all bad. Hamas is now, you know, a euphemism for everyone Palestinian. Or they're all right. And, you know, it's really time that we move away from that kind of thinking. It's not going to get us anywhere.
That was activist and journalist Jennifer Lowenstein speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio KBOO Portland.
Rev up your support for KABU Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KABU. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering